For one quarter of a century, they have thrilled us with their adventures, amazed us with their discoveries, and inspired us with their courage. Their ship has journeyed beyond imagination. Her name has become legend. Her crew, the finest ever assembled. We have traveled beside them from one corner of the galaxy to the other. They have been our guides, our protectors, and our friends. Now you are invited to join them for one last adventure. For at the end of history lies the undiscovered country. Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Welcome back, friends, to the 27th episode of the Shuttle Pod. We are recording this on Friday, November 18th, and I am here with, my name is Jared Whitley. I am co-host. I am co-hosting this with my good friends, Kayla Iacovino.
Hey, guys, how you doing?
And, of course, the inimitable Brian Drew.
Wow. Hi, everybody.
Okay, so in a couple weeks, we will celebrate the 25th anniversary of what important milestone in the Trek franchise?
It is going to be the 25th anniversary of Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, the final film featuring the original cast.
It came out on the 25th anniversary of the franchise, so it was sort of the midpoint of where we are right now. So Brian, what were your initial thoughts when you saw this a quarter of a century ago?
I loved it. It was a huge improvement over Star Trek V. Although that wasn't too difficult to pull off. It was beautifully done. They told a story that had relevance to the times, you know, the wall coming down and huge upheaval in the world at large. And
yeah, so Undiscovered Country came out in 1991, I believe?
Correct. December of 1991. So 2 years after the wall fell.
Yeah.
And they just did a tremendous job making it, like I said, relevant, and it was a wonderful, wonderful send-off for the original cast.
Yeah.
I was very pleased.
Yeah, I don't think you could have a more satisfying conclusion to a journey.
No, it was beautifully done.
And a great final scene, of course, where, you know, Kirk's giving the heading, you know, they're asked to come back to space dock to be decommissioned, and, you know, Spock says, what does he say? He says, I believe if I were human, I would say, go to hell.
And they do the little riff where they show the reaction shots while they're playing the main theme. It's such a beautifully directed moment.
Yeah, and then that wonderful allusion to Peter Pan.
Yeah.
Second star to the right and straight on till morning.
See, the thing that was weird about that, and this goes back to something we talked about in the 26th episode, the same time that this was in theaters, the movie Hook was in theaters. And so it was weird to have a Peter Pan reference while there was a Peter Pan movie going on. And I thought it was just a little excessive at the time. But, you know, it in retrospect, because I don't really care about the movie Hook, it's beautiful.
Except for actually in retrospect, Hook is awesome and everybody loves the movie Hook.
That is true. That is true. And irrefutable. And I think
we'll have to get a judge's ruling on that one.
Yeah. Kayla, what are your general thoughts on the Undiscovered Country at large?
Well, I cannot say that I saw it in theaters. I was very young when the movie came out. I would not have been able to comprehend anything going on. but I just rewatched it about an hour ago.
Oh, beautiful.
This is probably only the third time I've seen this movie, and I cannot tell you why, because this has got to be, I guess I just haven't watched it in a long time, and, you know, sort of grown as a Trekkie, I think, since the last time I watched it, and like all conversations with you guys, and just watching more and more of back of the original series, seeing more of the original series movies, and then finally coming back to this one. I have this like totally new appreciation for this film that I never had before, and I think it's competing for one of my favorite Star Trek movies now, where I didn't give it much thought previously.
Wow.
Well, that's great. Good. Yeah, that's magnificent.
I just really loved it.
Do you remember the first time you saw it?
I'm not sure. I mean, you know, over a decade ago, certainly. The first time I've seen it was probably a very long time ago, and I probably rewatched it again, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago or something. I mean, it's been a while since I've seen it, yeah. So. But yeah, I loved the ending. I loved the there's a like some kind of, you know, speech at the end that's basically like, I mean, it's very clear that they're passing the baton from from the TOS crew to the TNG crew, which is something that we talked about in another podcast that like sort of Generations was supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
Which now I'm like, why? Because, and I guess that was like the movie handoff, but I'm like, it felt, now that I'm going back and rewatching Undiscovered Country, I'm like, that seems totally unnecessary. Like they passed the baton already.
Here's the thing. I would say with Best of Both Worlds, Next Generation grabbed the baton and ran past wherever TOS had ever been. So I thought they never needed to pass the baton because their successor was already lapping them.
Yeah.
Which in no means should be taken as a slight on Undiscovered Country because it's magnificent.
Yeah, but it's just great to have Kirk sort of like put that into words and acknowledge like talking about, and you know, obviously being at peace with the Klingons was such a huge change in the Next Generation. Sure. And so like explaining the background of that and how it happened and having that be sort of the turning point between the two series. And like, that's sort of, that really sets up the Next Generation to be a totally different show.
Yeah.
And expanding that sort of classic Gene Roddenberry vision where the future is full of hope and peace.
Yeah. Yeah.
This idea that even the TOS crew, even though they were like so advanced compared to the 1960s, you know, we still have so much farther to go. And even, you know, in the 21st century, we'll still have farther to go. And then showing that like the Next Generation crew had been able to surpass that and keep going. But this idea that you're kind of never finished, you know, you never get to the Undiscovered Country, right? I guess you're like, it's always something that you're moving towards.
Almost as though, as one wise entity once said, the trial never ends, Kayla.
Exactly. My other favorite speech.
Yeah.
But I have to say, though, because I was just watching it, you know, this final scene where they say, second star of the right and stranded until morning. I always have to imagine that, like, after he gives that line and after the camera cuts, Chekhov's like, okay, but, like, actually, what heading?
Right? See, it's like, it's interesting because the impression I always get looking at Chekhov in that movie and that scene specifically is, I've been doing this for 25 years and I'm still at the same seat.
Yeah.
You could say that about the original cast and the Next Generation.
Except Sir.
They all stick around in their roles for way too long.
Well, except for Sulu.
No one had it as bad as Harry Kim. I just have to say.
Yeah, that's true. He never got promoted. The only character who never got promoted in all of Star Trek. Anyway, good plug for poor Harry Kim. Okay, so something I want to talk about, and where you mentioned the passing of the baton, is a couple weeks before this came out, it was when Leonard Nimoy guest starred on TNG with the Unification. And mm-hmm. so how well did Unification, I guess I'll try to smart Brian, if based on in your admission of your tender age. Brian, how well did the Unification continuity tie in to Undiscovered Country?
It was all right. They make vague allusions to the events that were coming up in the Undiscovered Country. They don't really, you know, come out and say what happened. I don't know. I mean, I know that the whole reason Leonard appeared on the show was to promote the movie.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it really helped sell the film that much ultimately.
It was,
to be honest. Unification was kind of just a hot mess anyway.
So. We mentioned that on our disappointing episodes. We listed Unification as one of them, I believe. But there is that moment where he says to Picard, perhaps you're aware of my small part in the role of the overture to peace with the Klingons. And
peace with the Klingons,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and Picard says, history is aware of your role, sir. And Spock says, not entirely, or something like that. And so there's...
Right, mm-hmm. and then there's some sort of allusion to putting Kirk in jeopardy, and then that's it. That's as far as they go.
Well, and I think what that was is there were those people who thought that Kirk would be killed in this in Undiscovered Country, and so it was it was teasing that.
Right, there were rumors going around.
And in fact, I think the reason they shot the scene with Marta, who was the Kamaloid when she was appearing like Kirk, is they shot the Kirk Kamaloid so that there would be video of, oh look, Kirk got shot, and so
I have to tell you, the first time I saw the trailer for the movie, I had a heart attack.
Yeah.
Did they show it?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
Why would they show that, though? That's like giving away the ending. That's what they want you to think, right?
No, you have no context for it. You have no idea what that is. But it looked like Kirk was being killed.
It could have been vaporized or beamed. They did it very well.
No, that didn't look like a beam, dude. That looked like a disruptor blast.
it definitely funneled with your expectations, which was the goal.
Absolutely.
Which was the goal.
It freaked me the hell out.
How lame would it have been if he did die and they gave it away in the trailer? How pissed would you be?
Yeah, of course. Oh, of course. Of course. But at the time, the visceral reaction, that trailer premiered during the 25th anniversary special
which was
its world premiere, so we're all sitting there at home watching it going, holy shit, it's because you'd never see it coming. So my initial reaction was one of like total panic, even though I knew very likely that nothing would happen to him,
at least for a couple of years, and then you get a bridge drop on him,
right?
Yeah,
that went really
after
well
wrestling in the desert. I'm so glad they didn't kill him in Undiscovered Country. That would have been stupid.
It would have been unsatisfying.
It would have been better off, maybe.
Nah,
oh, then what happened?
Considering his ultimate fate. Yeah.
Well, man, the better thing would just have been to not brought them back. To have not brought them back.
In generations, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there were show business considerations for that.
There were, which we've already discussed. Okay. Yes. So now you mentioned that they showed this as a trailer in the 25th anniversary, but there was also this magnificent teaser, Brian, that I know you and I have talked about before, they have Christopher Plummer giving this magnificent speech about, you know, for one quarter of a century, they have thrilled us with their journeys or whatever. And while they're doing that, they're showing clips from the original series and the original movies, and it sort of pans out. And then it's a shot of
it's projected onto the hull of the Enterprise.
Yeah. From I think it's a shot from motion picture, like
the motion picture
Beauty Pass before they go to warp speed. And that teaser, and what we'll do is we'll put the embed code to it on this page. So after you watch, listen to this, you can watch it. But that teaser still gives me goosebumps.
Me too. Yeah, it was beautifully done. Have you seen it, Kayla? You know what we're talking about?
No, I haven't seen it.
I highly recommend looking at it. All it is like a montage of images from the original series and the movies projected onto the hull of the Enterprise with a beautiful piece of music, like Jared said, and voiceover by Christopher Plummer, and it just sells it.
The music is from Star Trek III. It's the Genesis
Correct.
Planet
nice.
Music, I think.
Right. It's really nice.
Can I also say how awesome Christopher Plummer is?
Oh, gosh.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good segue right there. Let's go into talking about Christopher Plummer.
All right.
Kayla, tell us how awesome he is.
Very extremely awesome.
Okay. Well, let's say, have you seen the captains with the interview between, William Shatner and Christopher Plummer?
I have seen the captains, but I don't remember that interview.
Yeah. Because they were both like, as I recall, they're both like student actors at the same time, and they're both working on Hamlet or King Lear. And one was like the, understudy for the other. And like, William Shatner got
Shatner sick. Was the understudy for Plummer.
There you go. Yeah, and
I've totally forgotten about that.
Yeah, Plummer got sick one night, and so that was like Shatner's first big break. And they had the interview while like they're on stage together. It's magnificent to see these two guys talk together, because Christopher Plummer has had a little bit perhaps more of a storied career, you know, and so for him to to be a part of the franchise is an honor, not only for this movie, but ongoing.
For him to still be involved. Yeah, although I think it took them a while to sell him on doing it. He wanted nothing to do with wearing like all the appliances, I could see that. Stuff.
It's like a it's kind of goofy for him, right?
Because he's which is why if you see in the movie, he's really not that heavily made up.
No, he isn't.
Because that was one of his conditions for doing the movie, and it took them a while to convince him. It took Leonard Nimoy, I think, quite a while to get him to come around doing the movie.
Well, I'm glad he didn't give up.
No, he's like out of all the original cast villains outside of Khan, he's like the best. The movie villains.
I would agree. Yeah. I would agree. I just love how tough he looks with an eye patch bolted onto his face. Okay. I know I have a secret theory. I can't remember if I've shared this with you guys before, but this is my secret theory about how they designed the Chang character. Because what we have is this great British actor who quotes Shakespeare and is Kirk's equal. And so who does that remind you of? And he's bald.
Captain Picard.
I think in designing the Chang character, they said we want Kirk's final villain to be the Klingon version of Picard.
I don't think so.
That's basically what he is. He's quoting Shakespeare.
You got the Shakespeare and the bald thing.
That's just Nick Meyer.
I don't know.
That's just Nick Meyer.
Sorry,
dude.
No, I disagree. I respectfully disagree. Maintain my theory.
That's fine.
Yeah.
I don't think Nick nor Leonard Nimoy nor anybody else gave the Next Generation much consideration whatsoever when they were working on their movies. They had no reason to.
When they were working on the movies. I thought you just meant like they didn't care for them at all.
Oh, no. Not at all. That's not what I meant. Okay. But like, they just... I really don't
think... It wasn't a Next Generation film. But, I mean, they did give a lot of consideration to him, like, in that speech at the end, where this whole passing of the baton thing is very clearly directed at Next Generation. They even say things like, you know, where no man or no one has gone before. And, of course,
The original monologue that Shatner read was supposedly actually said Next Generation, and they changed it.
Oh, that's... Yeah. That's probably better.
Leonard Nimoy changed it.
That was a good call. Because instead he just said, like, to future crews or something like that.
Yeah, but it was still very obviously directed at the Next Generation crew.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, they didn't consider
I don't think they were crafting the movie based on Patrick Stewart or anybody else.
Sure.
Okay.
That's what I meant.
All right. Well, in terms of that, though, what do you think about the inclusion of Michael Dorn as Worf's grandfather? And the whole idea of naming it the Kittimer... kind of Kittimer, which was in continuity where Worf was from.
Yeah,
Worf. I thought it was fun. I thought it was great.
Worf being a part of that was so awesome.
Yeah, it was cool. I enjoyed it.
Is the defense attorney?
Yeah, and of course he stands up for our heroes. And right. Have you noticed how Klingon trials use a lot of the same nomenclature and tactics as United States trials? They have objections and sustained objections,
and the judge
with the gavel.
Go ahead.
There's an illusion in when Chang loses his cool with Kirk, when he says, "Don't wait for the translation. Answer me now."
Yeah.
That is a lift from Adlai Stevenson's talking to the Russian ambassador during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Very nice.
I was wondering because, I mean, supposedly, you know, Kirk doesn't speak Klingon, so that threw me for a bit of a loop. Like, how could he not wait for the translation? You know, what?
Yeah.
So that's crazy that that's part of real history. That's awesome.
That's one allusion, and there's another allusion to a bridge in the River Kwai when...
Oh, really?
Yes, when they arrive at the prison planet and the warden comes out of the prison onto the planet's surface and he gives a little bit of a monologue about where they are.
Uh-huh, and if you go outside, you'll die and everything. If you don't work well, you die.
Yeah, and that's basically paraphrasing a whole section of Bridge in the River Kwai.
Oh, interesting. That's fantastic. Good continuity there.
There's the Japanese, I guess, colonel is speaking to Alec Guinness and all of his soldiers in the movie, and that there's a little scene. So there's a little homage there. Sorry, I went off tangent.
No, that's very cool. That's perfect. I love it when I'm able to learn a piece of Star Trek trivia that I didn't know.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Glad I could impart that.
Exactly. Okay, now we talked about some familiar faces, like seeing Michael Dorn, but we have a couple others. For example, we have that you mentioned the guy who comes out and talks in the prison planet. He is played by the same actor who played Ira Graves, who was quote-unquote Data's grandpa in this TNG second season episode, The Shizoid Man. I don't know if you remember that. He's the guy who...
Morgan Shepherd, you mean?
I guess so. I could look it up. I can't remember his name. But he's the one who they find him on the planet, and he's this kind of, you know, crusty old man, very much the get-off-my-lawn phase of his old age. And he puts his, and he puts his consciousness into Data's brain at one point. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's the same actor who played that. And then, of course, we also have returning as Chancellor Gorkon, we have David Warner, who was in an unmemorable role in Star Trek V, and then would later go on to play Gul Madred in Chain of Command.
Yep.
So let's talk.
So good.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Gorkon and David Warner. Haley, you saw it most recently. What do you think about his presence as this progressive Klingon who wants to end, who wants to make war obsolete?
You mean from an actor standpoint, or
actor of the character, or all of the above?
I thought the acting was great. You know, he's only in it for the first quarter of the movie or something.
Because
he actually gets killed pretty quickly. But I think I bought his character. I totally bought into his character. That he had always wanted, maybe not always, but for a while has wanted, that peace was sort of the answer. But of course, he could never really push that agenda in given the way that the Klingon Empire was. And so he had to sort of wait for that when the moment was right, that it was actually going to be beneficial. And there's no other way that the Klingon Empire could continue to exist without this peace. So for him, it was like, well, this is a horrible thing that's happened, but maybe finally now I can convince people, you know, that peace is the real answer.
Yeah, it's his chance with this the explosion of Praxis, which is of course an allegory to begins with a G, but I keep thinking the word glasnost.
Chernobyl.
Why? It doesn't begin with a G, it begins with a C. Yeah, it's an allegory to the Chernobyl meltdown.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, very much so.
And then even the character of Gorkon is an allegory to Gorbachev, which is why they have the names start the same.
Oh.
Yep. And I mean,
what's allegorical?
There's also an allusion to Abraham Lincoln.
With the beard, yeah.
Yep.
Beyond the, you know, explosion, what's the rest of the allegory that I'm missing?
Oh, well, I think with Chernobyl, it devastated their power production, which is what Praxis is. It was their
key
energy production facility.
Yeah,
and then it also just it illustrated kind of the weakness of the Soviet Empire, that they couldn't keep up with the way the U.S. had advanced technologically.
Because I think they even say the Klingons have put so much resources into their military,
because of their enormous military budget.
I guess it went right over my head. But now that you say it, break it down, that makes sense. Makes total sense.
And I think there's another allusion to real world stuff in there too. When after the Praxis explodes and that Klingon Brigadier Kern comes on and says there has been an incident, but everything's under control. If I remember correctly, the Russian government did something exactly like that.
Wow.
Oh, interesting. Wow. Oh, yeah, probably.
Now, my memory may be playing tricks on me, but I'm pretty sure that happened. So that was another little, you know, nod to the real world.
I feel like I'm learning all about the Soviet era right now from having watched The Undiscovered Country.
I don't think there's a better way to teach someone about the fall of communism and how people felt than to show them this movie. And granted, I am biased because I co-host a podcast called The Shuttle Pod and write for a website called Trek Movie. But I still think this captures the spirit so well. And it you know, the allegory is in some ways, not in some ways, in every way heavy-handed, but it fits so well with the TOS allegory to, you know, the Starfleet is the United States and the Klingons are the Soviets. It's just a magnificent piece of history.
And it's like, it's a message of peace, though, too, which is pretty powerful. It's not like so the Klingons were kind of enemies, but not even really in this film. And it's saying like, because we'd already established that there had been peace, you know, because we've seen some of the Next Generation where there's peace with the Klingons. And so it's saying like, we can and we will move past this and we will be allies.
Yeah.
Okay. See, so and one like, of the what things, a great okay. message.
Yeah. Absolutely. And something that, I mean, we don't think about it now because it's so far in the past, but who knows what could have happened in the fallout of the collapse of the Berlin Wall. There could have been, you know, chaos, and there wasn't. We gracefully went into, an era of peace and prosperity.
Let's see. Other faces that were in the movie. New faces. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Kim Cattrall.
Yep.
That's right.
Now, but,
plays Valeris.
Yeah. So we need to, I'm sorry. Now, the Valeris character almost was a familiar face because there was talk of wanting to bring back Savick and make the Vulcan protege character Kirstie Alley again.
Right.
Would that have worked, or is it better for it to be a new character?
I think it's better to be new.
See, I think it actually would have been better if it were Savick.
Could you believe that she would turn like that?
Well, that's the whole thing. That would make it more of a surprise if Savick did turn.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, does anybody really surprised that Valeris was one of the conspirators? I mean, she's the newest person in the crew.
Yeah. One of these things is not like the other.
But at the beginning, Spock is like, you're my protege. You're going to replace me. And she's like, I could only ever succeed you.
Right.
And it's so you're like, and she was the first Vulcan to graduate at the top of her class from the academy and blah, blah, blah.
Which is crazy because you think every Vulcan would graduate at the top of their class.
Yeah, I agree.
So she did better than Spock at the academy, obviously.
Yeah. Apparently. Yeah, so I think it would have been cooler if it had been Savick. Although I know that Gene was not happy with the idea of them doing that to Savick because he felt that Savick was a fan favorite and people would get upset, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, because, it would make the rest of her appearances all sad because you'd be like, she's going to turn evil.
But it would have been a really big surprise, though.
Yeah, sure.
And I think, though, if I can touch on the word evil you use, I think one of the things that makes this so well is the adversaries in this film aren't evil.
Yeah, you're right. There was a bad word choice.
That's okay. But it gave me an opportunity to give this speech, so I appreciate it.
No, it's true.
Because the nature of this conflict is that people are just set in their ways, right?
Right.
It's like the thing that made them succeed in the world was that they were, quote unquote, cold warriors. In space, all warriors are cold warriors. And then history moves past them and their qualifications are no longer needed in a way. So I think in some ways that would have been terrific for it to have been Savick. I also think it might have been cool for them to have brought back one of the original Klingon captains like Tang or Kor to show the continuity there. I mean, as much as we like, you know, we just said how great David Warner and Christopher Plummer are. Wouldn't it have been cool to have William Campbell or John Colicos or Michael Ansara reprise one of their roles? Wouldn't that have been great?
Yeah. I love John Colicos. Dude, it would have been great.
That first episode with Aaron DeMercy, I see that as like the counterbalance to Undiscovered Country, because this is where the Cold War with the Klingons start. And I love that scene where Kirk and Kor are both arguing with the Organians, how dare you keep us from fighting? And Kirk realizes, oh, wait, in my own way, I'm just as militant as Kor is. So that would have been great to bring him back.
Yeah, it would have.
Although I think at this point in the franchise, there was not as much nostalgia for the original series as there would be in subsequent years.
Hmm.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
I mean, but it would have been great. Like you said, it was the 25th anniversary.
It was their 25th anniversary, Jared.
Yeah.
It was. But at this point, I think a lot of people were distracted by the new hotness of TNG. And a lot of the nostalgia that you see in the franchise didn't develop until like midway through Deep Space Nine for the original series.
I don't know about that.
Maybe nostalgia developed.
I'm specific. It could be. That certainly could be. But I'm thinking specifically in this case about the episode of Deep Space Nine where they brought back the three original Klingons. I don't know if you guys
But I don't know if that's necessarily due to nostalgia. Okay. I mean, part of it is.
I mean, even in if you're going to use that, like in TNG, Farpoint? What is the episode where Bones shows up?
4 point.
It is 4 point. Yeah. So very first episode.
Sure.
They were thrown back.
And then the second episode they do the sequel to the Naked Time, but right. I think I think they realized quickly that TNG had to be its own entity and they can't always be mining the franchise's history. Because you didn't see as much of that kind of stuff coming up. Or maybe you did. I don't know. We also see, now that I think about it, they did have an episode of TNG with Sarek, specifically called Sarek. Mm-hmm. And Sarek was a familiar face who was back in the Undiscovered Country.
I think
his role works really well as the Vulcan ambassador. And I know your father's the Vulcan ambassador, for heaven's sakes.
Yep. Yeah, it was cool. I always like a good Sarek appearance.
And another familiar face that's in that same scene and then later in the movie is Rene Aubergenois.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Odo from Deep Space Nine.
Right. In the director's cut of the film. The theatrical cut, he is not in.
He's
as Colonel West.
Yeah.
He's only in the director's cut?
Yep, he was not in the original theatrical version.
What? They cut out that whole subplot. I guess I just watched only the director's. I just watched the DVD that I own of it, and I guess it's the
director's cut. Yep.
So, but how does that work though? Because he was like a main part of the story, right? Because he at the end isn't he the one where they pull the mask off and they're like, oh my god, it's Odo.
And they never show the mask coming off.
They just make you think
Scotty
it's a Klingon.
Scotty just shoots him, and that's it. Yeah,
oh.
He's just a random Klingon.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
I don't know why they took it. You have to ask Nick Meyer why they took it out. I have no idea.
We have to ask him.
Maybe he says it on the commentary. But yeah,
right, Jared, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Maybe they thought it was too goofy to have him wearing a mask.
I don't know.
Well, the other thing is that's a setup for the whole reason why they have the pink, or as perhaps a wiser person told me, the magenta blood that the Klingons have floating around, is to show, okay, here's the Klingons, their blood looks different. And then when Scotty shoots Colonel West,
he sees his red.
Worf says, this is not Klingon blood. And then there's the Scooby-Doo scene where they pull the mask off. And so it's kind of cutting that out makes the Klingon's blood being magenta.
Pointless. Gratuitous. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Also, I do remember this from when I did listen to the Nick Meyer commentary. He makes a big deal about, yeah, they'd never shown that Klingon blood was this color, but now that we did this, it's continuity that their blood is this color forever. In no other scene in Star Trek have they ever had Klingon's blood look like that, like the Pepto-Bismol or whatever it was. It's always just been red.
Really?
Yeah.
Nuh-uh. Oh, wait. Oh, yeah, I guess if you see them getting stabbed and stuff in TNG.
Yeah, it's
I swear
red.
There's some allusion to their blood being purple or pink.
There might be an episode of Enterprise where they do it, but like whenever Worf cuts his or General Martok cut their hand to show they're not changelings,
it's just regular blood.
It's just regular human looking blood.
That is super lame. I just realized that. How lame?
It is lame.
That's great stuff, by the way. The zero G blood.
Oh yeah, and it still looks good.
Yeah,
it still
look great.
Oh.
Sorry.
No. For the time, it was tremendous.
Yeah, it looks pretty bad. But so, how did they do such a good job? So the changeling character, whenever she changed form, I thought it looked great. The CG on that. So
that was early. That was early morphing.
How did they do such a good job of that and make the blood look so shitty?
The tech was still coming along at that point, Kella. It was the early 90s.
They didn't outsource the blood.
It was all ILM.
Something to mention is this came out a few months after Terminator 2, which was where the morphing special effect really got perfected. And it's also sad because in any other year, this would have won the Oscar for best special effects, but Terminator 2 just ran away with it.
Yeah. The Undiscovered Country benefited from all the R&D that ILM did for Terminator 2, basically.
Okay. Because the morphing looked awesome, I thought.
Yeah, all the liquid stuff and all the morphing and all that had been done for the Abyss and Terminator 2 and stuff like that. And the Undiscovered Country was a happy beneficiary of that.
Whenever I watch the scenes with the Klingon blood floating around, I just figure, it's alien blood, so it might not look quite like a normal, because I'm imagining it looking like how human blood would look floating around, but just a different color. But I can just be like, oh, no, it's some weird sci-fi blood, so it can look like that. That's not bad CG. That's actually what it looks like.
Right.
I can explain it away in my head.
It just has a different consistency.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So So now it's canon that the blood has to be rendered in the same way.
That's
if we
right.
see it again, tell, it has to be all shiny.
Tell the crew of Discovery. That's what we demand. Bring
you know
all
what,
this.
Though?
Bring what?
Yeah, if Nick Meyer, you know, is on Discovery.
That's right.
Is writing,
he is.
So if we see blood and it's not purple, I'm
going to
be pissed.
There's going to be hell to pay.
There's going
to
be hell to pay.
There's going to be hell to pay. I am going to write a strongly worded letter.
Yeah. Absolutely. I can't wait to see this. A letter to the editor in The Hollywood Reporter.
I'm going to call it right now because I think this would actually be a really funny satire piece. If that happens, I'm going to write like a satirically angry fan, like Star Trek fan letter, open letter to Nick Meyer, and I'll publish it on the site.
Excellent.
I'm
well done.
All right.
Laying that out now.
Okay, so talking of special effects, I also want to talk about the Praxis explosion as a way of starting the film. Because the Praxis explosion is awesome.
It is,
yeah, it is.
It is awesome. I have one problem with it, but I will.
I might know what your problem is, so tell me, let me see if I'm reading your mind.
Okay, so a planet blows up. Well, a moon blows up, sends a shockwave through the system, the area. And then they go back and show it, and there's like, about a third of it still there, and the rest has been exploded. How? Explosions move in all directions.
Yep.
How is part of it just still hanging there?
Yeah, I was wondering.
If the rest of the planet is totally vaporized, if there's enough energy in an explosion to vaporize the rest of the planet, how is that other chunk still there, and how is it still in the same orbit?
Oh, okay, so
I agree. That always bothered me too.
Let me introduce another problem. This is what occurred to me. How did that shockwave travel faster than light in order to get to wherever the Excelsior was?
Did it?
Because, unless they're in the Kronos system, the shockwave wouldn't reach them unless it's able to get out of the solar system, in which wherever the Excelsior is, they would have to travel faster than light for them to get there.
Excelsior's in the Beta Quadrant. Isn't that where Kronos is?
Yeah, but unless they're like right next to the Klingon homeworld, right?
Well, do they establish how much time it took for the shockwave?
Yeah, we don't act. That's a good point.
It seems like it's immediate, though.
It seems like it, but it might. I mean, we don't actually see it originate. We just see it.
Right. We don't
see
it originate and hit the Excelsior.
And then we're seeing that this originated from here. So maybe they do specify a time, but if they don't, like that could have happened hours or days ago.
Yeah, I agree with Kayla.
Even still, no, but I mean, like one light year means the amount of distance it takes for light to travel in 1 year, right? So
if it's
sublight speed of any kind, you'd have to be in the same solar system for it to hit it.
That's actually true.
Yeah.
Well, you have to be, you could be outside probably of the solar system, but not by very much. You have to, in terms of how big the Star Trek universe is, you could be outside of the Kronos system, but you'd still have to be pretty close to it.
You'd have to be very close. You'd have to be right on the Klingon's doorstep.
For it to reach you within a year. So you're right. They'd have to be in the system.
Yeah.
If it's light hours of travel time, that's within the system for sure.
So despite the fact that it's an awesome effect, there may be a couple scientific issues with it.
Well, maybe it sent some kind of subspace shockwave because of the nature of the explosion. And space can be
warped.
It can be warped, and it can actually, like, I don't want to say it can travel faster than the speed of light, but, like, for example, the rate at which this is true, real, non-science fiction, real universe, the rate at which the universe is expanding is faster than the speed of light.
And oh, interesting.
The actual fabric of space is what's moving. So it's not this, space isn't traveling through itself. Space is actually being stretched. And so that process can happen much faster than the speed of light. So if it were some subspace shockwave, then maybe that could, that was actually rippling through the space-time fabric, that could travel faster than light.
All right. Okay. I forgive
them.
I forgive them. However, your original concern remains.
Yeah. That half of a planet wouldn't explode and leave the other half.
The other thing is the reason why we see that kind of ring explosion effect is because planets have most of their mass around the equator, right? Which is why that's the orbit they travel in. Is kind of horizontally there. And so if it would explode around the middle, there might have been some stuff from the around like the poles that would have survived, but it wouldn't look like just a giant had come and taken a bite out of the moon.
Right, and they would have been shot out in either direction. There's no way that the
exactly
those chunks would still be hanging around.
Yeah.
It looks cool, though, I have to say. It looks awesome when they go back and look at it, and they're like, oh my god, that used to be Praxis.
Yeah. And something that we need to talk about is the influence of that shot on the Star Wars franchise, because when Lucas a couple years later did the special editions and they make the Death Star explode, both Death Stars, they recreate the Praxis effect to make the explosion more dramatic.
Yep.
And they do it.
That was the quote-unquote shockwave look for a long time.
Yeah.
That was it.
Very influential.
It looked so good, too. It really looked like a wave with the Excelsior, almost like a surfboard or a boat or something that's really like an actual wave in the ocean. Like it's being pushed up and thrown, you know, against the force of that wave. It looked great, I thought.
And Sulu, who was born in San Francisco and I'm sure surfed as a young man, knew exactly how to deal with it.
Yeah, head straight into it.
I love that they show his competence in that scene.
Yeah, he was awesome.
Yep.
So here's a question for you guys that you probably know the answer to. Why did they have Sulu like sort of captaining his own ship and not amongst the rest of the main crew?
Here's the thing. Well, go ahead, Brian.
Well, he originally was supposed to be promoted to captain in the Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, and in fact, in the novelization, he is.
And he is, yes. Yeah. In fact, it's in that there's supposed to be a bunch of dialogue when they're in the travel pod heading toward the Enterprise in the Wrath of Khan, where, you know, Sulu says, any chance to go aboard the Enterprise? There's more dialogue after that they cut out, where they start talking about how Sulu is being promoted soon, or is promoted, or something along those lines, and will be getting his own ship soon. It was cut out. I'm not 100% sure why, but it was taken out.
Mm-hmm.
There's a theory, which is that, and this may be unfair, that Kirk didn't want anybody else to be captain but him, and so he said, no, don't make Sulu a captain. I don't know if that's true, but that's the theory.
No,
because Spock was a captain.
And according to Shatner, like he said, George mentioned to him that he wanted to become a captain, and Shatner said to him, why would you want to do that, George? If you go off on another ship, you're not going to be with us, and you're not going to be in the movie very much.
Yeah, okay. That's
which is kind of true.
I like that explanation better.
But I don't know. I mean, I have heard rumors, too, that Shatner kind of fluffed his lines, too, when they were doing those scenes. So I don't know. But we've never seen it, so we have no way of knowing if that was true.
Yeah. It's so long ago.
So anyway, that seed had been planted in the Wrath of Khan, Kayla.
Okay. It just felt like it was almost like, well, was George Takei like, not available to shoot scenes with the rest of the cast? Like, you know, it was noticeable that he was separate. It was awesome. And he really was integral to the plot, which I appreciated. It wasn't just like a cameo.
George pushed for it.
Okay. No, that's cool. I liked it.
The other thing is, if I recall correctly, originally the opening act of Undiscovered Country was going to be very much Kirk getting the band back together again, and everybody was to have been off doing their own thing. But as I recall, they didn't have the budget for it. Like,
it's also an old and tired. We've already done that.
It also would have really slowed down the beginning of the movie.
It wasn't necessary.
Yeah, and the TOS crew has already done that get the band back together thing. So why that seems silly.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's better the way it came out in the end.
I thought it was perfect at the beginning because they're all like, "Why are we here?" And then Shatner's like, "And where's Spock?" And then Spock comes out to give the speech to everyone who's gathered.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So, also we need to mention to our familiar faces that Grace Lee Whitney was on the Excelsior.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. Good one.
Communications officer.
Yeah. And then they would bring both her and Sulu back, of course, for the Voyager episode Flashback, which now that I recall it, did have a cameo from Michael Ansara as Kang.
Yep.
Can I also say that the Enterprise A is the best Enterprise?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, the refitted Enterprise is the best Enterprise.
Beautiful.
It really is. That model is just perfect.
I love the bridge, too.
See, I don't like the one that they made for Star Trek 5 and 6. I think it's kind
of
ugly.
Really? I like it. I like that it's very open. It reminds me also a lot of the Enterprise E bridge, the sort of geometry of the front part. Hmm. Oh, also, this is maybe something we can talk about more because it's, I guess, ubiquitous in the TOS movies. The engineering uniforms. They have those like collars on them. So they're different colors, but they have white ones with like dark collar, almost dark brown or black collars. I guess they're black. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I can't, every time I see one of those, all I can think that those collars look like is the wrapper from a Reese's cup.
and now I will too.
So when they came out, they came on the screen, I was like, yay, the Reese's guys.
I do want to say, you mentioned the costumes. I think that this movie has the best production values of any Star Trek movie in terms of how good all the costumes look, in terms of how good all the sets look. I like, and there's the detail of showing the galley and like people making the food. And like, there's that great scene where Valeris vaporizes the pot, but the mashed potatoes stay there. I just love the way this film looks.
Did she vaporize the pot and then like that made them harden or something? I didn't get why the mashed potatoes didn't collapse.
Because they were just being stirred. The potatoes aren't even prepared and they're just being stirred.
But
why wouldn't they like slump down into a pile? Like they stayed in the shape of the pot and even the whisk stayed sticking out of it. Like it was obviously a piece of plaster with a whisk in it.
Well, Kayla, clearly you have never vaporized a pot with mashed potatoes in it because that's exactly what happened. Brian and I do it all the time. How come you never come to us at our potato vaporizing parties?
I thought maybe the idea was
vaporizing
like,
parties.
I thought the idea was that like they vaporized the pot and that like heated up the mashed potatoes and like sort of sintered them.
Oh, that could be.
I don't know.
That could be
into a single mass. But I thought it was weird that they like. I thought it was like speaking of this scene, which was like because I thought it was supposed to be like a little comedic that it left the whisk in there.
Yeah,
like there was a news story. Yeah. It was like, oh crap.
Yeah, the whole thing's a gag.
Yeah, and then people keep running in like, did someone set off a phaser in here?
Yeah.
Just to say, perfect amount, I thought, of levity and humor in this film. And the humorous moments were great. They were just, they hit it right on.
My favorite humorous moment is when they're going through the sleuthing scene and like Spock quotes the Sherlock Holmes and he says, a bird of prey, and raises his eyebrow. And then it cuts to Valeris and she raises her eyebrow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just a great little gag.
I also love the scene with Kirk and Bones in Rurapente. The changeling is coming in and like starts like, you know, putting the moves on Kirk, and I think they start making out or something, and
they do.
Bones just like rolls his eyes and sighs. Mm-hmm. And Kirk says,
what,
you know,
is it with you anyway?
Yeah, what is it
I
with
love
you
that.
Anyway?
Such
and
a great
Kirk
laugh.
Says something about like when she leaves, he says something about like, are you you're still like sure that this is gonna be the end for us or something? And he's like, No more than ever.
Yeah.
And I love
Dave Kelly has a lot of great lines in this movie.
I love that guy.
They use him so great in that. I love the callback to the Marta makeout scene where she looks like her and he says, I can't believe I kissed you. And she says, must have been your lifelong ambition.
Yeah. And also when she had changed to that big hairy creature. They're talking about her and Bones says something about, weren't the two of you last night? And he's like, don't remind me.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some great moments from Dave Kelly.
Yeah, where Bones and Spock are performing operation on the torpedo, and Bones says at one point, I'd pay real money if he'd shut up.
Real money if he'd shut up.
Well, Chang is spouting off all his lines from Julius Caesar.
That's right.
Yeah, that cast had chemistry.
Yeah, it did.
Out the yin-yang.
Yeah, impossible to compare with that kind of charisma.
You know, what a great film. What a great way to end the run of the original series, because it was fun and it was meaningful and it was thoughtful and it encapsulated like positive values. It had like a lot of the Star Trek heart in it, and it was very like you came away from it feeling like happy and motivated and like, you know, hopeful for the future, and at the same time sort of some sense of closure to the whole thing. I don't know. There's something, like I said, just watch it. So I'm kind of coming off of this like high of watching the film, but I just finished it with that this awesome feeling. And I was just like, this was perfect. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not watching it from the perspective of that I would have had in 1991, but from watching it from this perspective of that I have currently in 2016, like that was a perfect way to end TOS.
Yep. I think, absolutely. It is a superlative film. And I think that's the hallmark of an excellent film, is if it's something you see several years later and you're able to realize, oh, wait, there's stuff in here that's amazing that I never knew.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And the movie came out at the end of the year, and it had been a wonderful 25th anniversary.
Yeah.
And it put a nice bow on the entire thing. It mm-hmm. really was great. The 25th anniversary was so much better than the 50th.
I was about to say, can you terrific. Imagine an anniversary where they put a nice bow on the end of a nice year?
Yeah.
I mean, it was so much better. We had the original cast making a great movie. TNG was doing well. Mm-hmm. It was just that to me, I know a lot of people point to 94 as being the peak of the Star Trek franchise. I don't think it is. I think 91 is the peak.
I completely agree.
Because Star Trek is, for all intents and purposes, the original series and Star Trek The Next Generation, and they were both firing on all cylinders that year.
Yeah. Or thrusters, if we can analogy.
If I remind you that Starfleet regulation says you must only use thrusters while in space dock.
She's a Vulcan, all right.
I love how Spock clears his throat.
Yeah, he's like, shut the hell up.
I just love that Kirk's like, this is my last mission. I'm going to peel out of the parking lot. I don't care who I crash into.
Yeah. Well, Jim Kirk was never known for following orders anyway.
Yeah.
So.
I was known to disobey orders from time to time or something in the trial. I love how they use that against him as well in the trial. Chang uses the fact that Kirk has disobeyed orders so many times. Like, he's like, you disobey orders whenever you feel like you need to, basically. That was like him establishing Kirk's character, saying that he would have done that again.
Okay, so something that I try to bring up when we talk about these movies is, what is the stated theme of the movie? Like, we hear, usually, like I say, the stated theme, the hero will hear something at the beginning, a line from a mentor or something, he doesn't really grasp it, and then by the end of the movie, he repeats the line to show he's learned the lesson from this adventure he's had. What is the stated theme for the lesson that Kirk has learned in Undiscovered Country?
People can be very frightened of change.
There it is, How can history get past someone like me?
Yeah.
I think it works really well. I think it works really well the way they spell it out.
He says at the beginning of the film about the Klingons, Spock is like, they're going to die. They're going to die, Kirk. And he says, let them die.
Oh,
let
gosh. Let them die. I love
that. By the way, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I love the tension in that scene, that they're unapologetically making these two friends really pissed off with each other.
Yeah. That didn't go over too well with Shatner or Gene Roddenberry, I don't think. They thought it made Kirk look really bad. And, at that point, Gene was heavy into his pacifist mindset and didn't want – he hated – the tone of the Undiscovered Country.
Well, he was also. I mean, by the time Undiscovered Country was released, he had died. So he
was very. He saw it a week before he died.
Wow.
Oh.
But it's so positive. I mean, the tone is so positive, and it's so. Yeah. It feels like it has the Gene Roddenberry heart in it. Like, I mean, okay, he didn't like him saying let them die, but like the character had reason to hate the Klingons. They had killed his son. And he is a very passionate person, and like he grows.
As having been his mortal adversary for 25 years.
Right. Yeah. And he grows beyond that at the end of the film. So, and he fights.
He didn't like. I'm sorry.
No, just go ahead.
No, he also didn't like when that. How about that smell? Only top of the line models can even talk. Like that stuff. Gene didn't.
Oh yeah.
Hated.
Yeah.
But aren't they showing that, like, the point was, like, people are prejudiced. The point was that people today are prejudiced and that there's a reason that they are. And there's even a line, so I can't remember who says it, but someone says, I think, to Kirk, when this change is all going to happen, like, our generation is going to have the hardest time with
Gorkin. Gorkin says it.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, I mean, so if there's you can't just ignore all the, like, prejudice in the world. There are We all have prejudices. Even the great bird of the galaxy has his prejudices.
Yeah, and that prejudice was required for them to be warriors, right? They had to be adversarial toward their mortal enemies.
And the point of this is that you have to admit that you have a prejudice in order to overcome it. I thought.
Exactly.
Yep.
So to me, that's like such a positive thing. And just saying
you have to have an arc.
Yeah, for Jean to say that, oh, no one has any prejudices. It's like, how can you be forward-looking if you can't admit where you are currently?
But Jean was in his TNG mindset, guys.
Yeah.
That's what Jean thought. By the mid-80s, that was the way Jean thought about everything. So
that's too bad, because I think this film had so much of that, what I consider to be the Roddenberry, what I'm calling the Roddenberry heart, which is that
forward-thinking...
Like, we can do better. We can always do better.
Yep. I agree with you, Kelly.
So, it's sad to me that he didn't like it. But maybe given time, if he had had extra time, he would have grown to realize the value of it. Who knows?
Yeah.
Hope so. Well, wherever he is, may the great bird of the galaxy bless his planet.
And all planets.
And all planets. And all planets. Thank you. Especially planets that need to explode and achieve faster than speed of light velocity to move the plot along. Okay, so along those lines, we've been talking for an hour. Is there anything else we want to say to put this close this book and put it back on the shelf for the night?
I don't have a Trek anecdote or anything, but I just want to say, if the Great Bird of the Galaxy is going to bless all the planets in the universe, do you think there's like a planet that's just all bunnies, or the planet that's just like all kittens?
That would be very cool.
Because I think there should be.
Maybe like the Tribble planet?
Yeah, where's like the Tribble home planet? Where do they come from? You know, there's just like, you know, there's these like islands in Japan where it's just like all cats. And there's like a bunny one. I think they should have planets like that. Anyway, that's my closing thought for the day.
Wow.
The universe needs more bunnies and kittens, ladies and gentlemen.
And Tribbles. And I hope you will consider my request. And I'll take my question off the air.
Amen. Hey, thanks, everybody. Hey, thanks for tuning in, everybody. This is Shuttlepod episode 27. We recorded this on November 18th, 2016. And if you haven't, please celebrate the 25th anniversary of Undiscovered Country by rewatching it, just as Kayla has done, and Brian and I, I'm sure, will try to do in the next few weeks. And we will see you for episode 28.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.